It is possible, mind you, that there is some light at the end of the supply chain tunnel. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 6th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So let us review here, as a way to get going, the long and twisted saga of supply chains in this pandemic economy the past 2.5 years. COVID hits, we start buying stuff, lots and lots of stuff. So retailers start scrambling to build up their inventories, both imported and domestic goods, so that they can meet that demand. And then we start spending more on services and less on stuff, which meant all that inventory had all of a sudden become excess. Not an ideal state of affairs. If you're a retailer, you don't want excess inventory. But we learned this week, thanks to something called the Logistics Managers Index, that inventories have finally come back down to where they were in the before times. And as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports to get us going, that is a sign supply chains are getting back to normal.
In the last few months, retailers have been using several strategies to try to get rid of all that extra inventory, says Zach Rogers at Colorado State University, who puts together the Logistics Managers Index.
There's been large write-downs. There's been a lot of goods shifted into secondary market retailers like dollar stores or TJ Maxx and places like that. And also there's been a slowdown in orders.
And that slowdown in orders has had a knock-on effect on supply chains more broadly. Rogers says, look at what's happened to the price of shipping containers as demand for them has fallen.
The cost of a 40-foot container going from East Asia to the West Coast of the United States is about $1,400 right now. A year ago, that was close to $20,000.
It's also not taking as much time to import products. Pat Whalen handles imports at Sahadi's, a grocery store and wholesaler in Brooklyn.
You know, you're not over-ordering, ordering early, anticipating that something that would take 30 to 60 days to get will take 90 to 120 days to get. You're not thinking like that anymore.
Whalen says that feels great.
I mean, it's been a long couple of years to have that other added pressure about dealing with supply. Now I feel like that's not much of an issue anymore.
But Whalen's not getting too excited and loading up on inventory.
While it's a cheaper freight rate, it'll be offset by the carrying costs of having the inventory, paying for the inventory, storing the inventory, if the sales are not there to move the inventory through.
And the sales might not be there if the economy slows down next year. Lisa Elram is a professor of supply chain management at Miami University in Ohio. She says Pat Whalen's not the only retailer being cautious right now.
We do have this looming threat of a recession, and they've just sort of come through this. And they're kind of going, whew, wow, we survived that one somehow.
Elram says retailers are likely to be a lot more judicious next year about what they stock up on, so they're not left holding the bag if the economy goes south. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street this Tuesday, more down than up as a couple of big bank CEOs made noises about an economically unappealing future. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I took a drive out to Inglewood this past Friday, out near LAX, to a 50-plus-year-old aerospace and defense business called the Marvin Group. It's a manufacturing plant, but think more high-tech than heavy industry.
Oh, it's very clean roomy. It's very clean roomy.
I came to talk to this guy.
Hey, Dr. LaPlante, Kai Rizdahl, nice to see you, sir. How are you?
Bill LaPlante, thanks for coming.
Absolutely. Dr. William LaPlante is the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition and Sustainment. Fancy way of saying he's the country's chief weapons buyer. He was in Southern California last week for the unveiling of the new B-21 bomber, among a bunch of other things, including visits to defense contractors like this one.
Companies like these guys are the central point of our hierarchy needs because what they do are the critical interfaces, so say pylons, between aircraft and certain weapons and other systems aircraft carry. So these are kind of the important middlemen or middle person in our weapon systems, and they are the backbone of our industrial base, companies like this.
I don't want to get too technical here, but when you say the pylons between the aircraft and the weapons, it's literally the launchers, right?
Yes.
It's the launch racks and the ejector racks that these guys
put together. That's right. And it has to work on multiple different airplanes with multiple different weapons.
So when I say defense industrial base to you, which is your lingua franca, right? That's your thing. Translate that to the wider audience and make them understand why it matters.
Yeah, so the term defense industrial base traditionally refers to companies that do contracting with the Department of Defense. But having said that, increasingly we're seeing that the blurring is between what does defense industrial base and just the regular economics in the United States.
Okay, so we'll get there in a second. I want to talk about the changes you want to make in the defense supply chain, right? Because it's a lot of money that Americans are spending on the defense supply chain. Talk to me first, though, about this moment, about number one, the current political climate, and number two, Ukraine and what the American defense establishment is doing in Ukraine.
Yeah, so I think coming out of COVID, and we're still obviously dealing with COVID, all of us have recognized and seen in our lives that the just-in-time economy, the minimized inventory, it's not resilient. That's the big change we're seeing. I think what we're seeing in the political climate is a recognition that the industrial base of the United States needs this attention, and we do need and can bring more manufacturing back to the United States. Just like in defense, manufacturing and design, I think, have to be much more integrated.
You want to onshore your supply chain?
As much as you can, or friendshore, as they say.
Friendshore. I want to ask about Ukraine.
Yes.
And I want to ask about the support the American defense establishment is giving, and I want to talk about whether you have the capacity, because they are going through, as you know better probably than anybody, huge numbers of American weapons over there. Javelins and the artillery shells, they're going through our entire inventory.
Right.
It's your job to fill the shelves back here.
Right.
Are you doing it?
Yes. Thanks to a lot of action by the Congress, we've gotten various colors of money, billions of dollars in different categories. One is we've gotten $4 billion we've put on contract to replenish our inventories of equipment we have sent to Ukraine. But the second piece of it is we're looking at what equipment, and this happens every day, that would affect what the Ukrainians are needing in the fight. And that has changed since February.
But just to take one weapon system, which is really high profile, the Javelin anti-tank weapon system, right? They've gone through, I think the number I saw was 8,500 of them, right? And we make 850 a year. How can you keep up with that?
Well, so there's two numbers you think about. Number one is, what is your production rate? Which is what you just referenced. But more importantly, what is your stockpile to begin with? We look at both of those. We look at what is the risk that can be taken if we draw down. And in some cases, we have had excess capacity or plenty of capacity where drawing down has been fine. At the same time, while we're doing all this, we are working on near-term and longer-term solutions. For Javelin, for example, bringing more contract second suppliers online, helping with obsolescent parts.
You gave a speech last month, middle of last month, I think, that I saw described as feisty. You were clearly in a mood about how we do defense contracting in this country. Mm. And you talked about this idea of doing it 1 year at a time is insane. We need multi-year contracting authority. And I guess my question is, with the amount of money you're spending, not you, but your department, how confident are you that the Congress of the United States is going to let you do multi-year contracting with that amount of money, in a changing political environment, when our conflict response is kind of dependent on world affairs?
So a couple things on that. I would say point number one is we need a budget. We don't have a budget right now, so I would urge the Congress to get us a budget. We're operating off of continuing resolution, as we have too many times. The second point I would make is the amount of money is one thing. But what we have to do is think through the contracting approaches, which is where you're going,
right,
that gives industry and suppliers a chance to say, this is not a fly-by-night endeavor. They're going to be in this for 3 years so they can go back to their boards, their investors, and make capital improvements. Because I think what you're hearing from industry is demand signal. They want to see that next year it's not going to go away.
Do you think the average American reading the newspaper about, and I'm going to, you know, poke in the eye here, reading the newspaper about the $847 billion that they're talking about for the defense authorization bill, right? Somebody's reading that and saying, $1 trillion? Are you kidding me?
Yeah. Certainly the size of any budget is something people should be asking about. All I would say to that is, number one, We have right now a conflict where either the second or third greatest power in military power is right now in an existential threat with a country that we're partnered with. This is one of those national moments that both sides of the aisle where we're standing up to do it. Is it an investment by the United States? Absolutely. Was the Marshall Plan, and you know, we've done this before, but it always should be, the question always should be answered. And the Defense Department, like every other department, should have to defend its budget. And when the questions always should be looked at.
You're at the table when the Secretary of Defense and possibly the President are thinking about national defense strategy. In your billet as the acquisitions guy, what is your advice to them as to where we need to be spending our money?
So my advice, if you look at the national defense strategy, it really talks about what's called integrated deterrence, which is we have to invest in capabilities that adversaries will see and will actually deter them from acting. The second piece is, in many ways, China is the pacing threat. There's as much about that as economics as it is military. And I think it's caused us to look at, and we saw this during COVID, look at our supply chain through the context of the global competition. Not just the defense supply chain, but all supply chains. And the other thing I encourage is, yes, we have a near-term issue right now with Ukraine, but let's also take the longer-term perspective. So 3-4 years from now, we will end up with a modern 21st century industrial base. That's my biggest thing, is this is an opportunity for us to get that 21st century industrial base.
I'll get the plug in here, right? Economic security is national security.
They're the same, but you can't separate them. When you get down to the second or third tier suppliers, on one day they're a mom and pop shop doing stuff for us, and then the second day they're doing it for somebody else. It is intertwined.
Dr. LaPlante, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Okay, change of gears here, but also a true story. One of my kids asked me the other day whether we've got a subscription to Disney Plus, and I said we had one, but we canceled it. An hour later, that same kid comes back to me and he says, yeah, no, Dad, we do have one. It's part of our Hulu subscription. And then he helpfully pointed out that for a while there, we'd obviously been paying for both. I mention that because there is word today that HBO Max, which replaced HBO Now, which replaced HBO Go, or I think it went like that. Anyway, it's coming back to Amazon Prime, which, of course, has its own streaming service called Amazon Prime Video, which in turn means you'll once again be able to subscribe to one streaming service, HBO's, through another's, Amazon's. Streaming partnerships like that are pretty common, but oh, so very hard to untangle. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looks at why watching your favorite show has gotten so messy.
Eleanor Patterson has been on a multi-year quest to finish watching Murder, She Wrote.
This is kind of like a scavenger hunt where we have to go seeking out, like, piece by piece to find our content.
First, it was on Netflix. Then it disappeared and eventually popped up on Amazon Prime Video. Patterson actually researches broadcast distribution at Auburn University. And she says even for her, it's becoming more difficult to figure out where to find shows and movies.
I do think integration is king.
Integration, like one streaming service living inside another. Log in and watch anything. So Amazon Prime Video is trying to become the Amazon of streaming. Tim Hanlon is a media analyst at the Vertair Group.
We are in the middle of a great reset of how programming gets paid for and delivered to consumers.
Having a hit show that simply gets people to subscribe and cancel when they're done binging, that was never enough. So streaming platforms are experimenting with different subscription models, advertising strategies, and these partnerships with competitors. Jennifer Kent is VP of Research at Parks Associates.
Especially the leaders are transitioning from trying to build the most market share and the biggest customer base they can to more of a focus on profitability.
She says niche content companies, say BritBox or Crunchyroll, might have an easier time turning a profit. But most of the bigger platforms are having trouble. Netflix recently claimed it's the only large-scale streaming company making money.
So I do think that you're going to see more acquisitions, you know, those who aren't able to kind of show that they can turn a profit, maybe being eaten up by some of the larger services.
Until then, you'll have to figure out your own method to the madness. Something like watching The White Lotus via HBO Max, via Amazon Prime, via Roku, via your TV. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the patterns of retaliation and brutal treatment are horrible.
All is not well in the meat industry, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 350 points, 1%, 33,596. The NASDAQ down 225, 2%, 11,014. The S&P 500 got rid of 57 points, 1 4/10%, 39.41. We heard from Justin Ho about retailers still in a quest to shed their excess inventory. Some of that backlog has fallen because businesses have pared back their ordering, and some of the excess goods have gone to secondary markets like discount stores. Thus, Dollar Tree fell 1 8/10% today. TJX Companies, which owns TJ Maxx and Home Goods, shed 0.1%. Ross stores dropped 0.7%. Kristen was just telling us about HBO Max coming back to Amazon Prime after a year's absence. That's thanks to a deal that HBO's new owner, Warner Brothers Discovery, made with Amazon. WBD is the ticker there. Warner Brothers Discovery flopped 4 8/10% today. Amazon down 3%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Business relationships come in all varieties. They can be warm and collegial, productive for all sides, or they can be bitter, untrusting, antagonistic even. Airports and airlines, they've got that latter one. The head of the aviation trade body, IATA, it represents airlines, said not too long ago that a bleeding airport is music to his ears. That's a quote. And he accused airports of gouging airlines with fees. Well, the head of a European airport industry association basically said airlines were one to talk the way they're gouging customers. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour had a look at how things got so nasty between airports and airlines.
The relationship between airlines and airports is straight out of the African savannah, if you ask Andrew Charlton, Managing Director of Aviation Advocacy.
The gazelles wake up every morning and they start running because the lions are about to chase them. And the lions wake up every morning and they start running because the gazelles are running. And that's the relationship between airlines and airports in a nutshell.
Unclear who is the gazelle and who is the lion, but the tension between airports and airlines comes down to money. Airports charge airlines fees for using them, and many airports are trying to increase those fees. David Primo is a professor at the University of Rochester.
The airports lost a significant amount of money during the pandemic. Of course, the airlines are also badly hit. The difference now is that the airlines have recovered, but the airports are still, in their mind, trying to make up for lost time.
The fees are more significant to airports than they are to airlines, says Samuel Engel, a senior vice president at ICF.
For airports, typically 60% of their revenue comes from airline charges, whereas for airlines, the airport charges represent a small portion of their total costs, typically in the neighborhood of 5 to 6%.
But still, it's a fight over a pot of money. Again, Andrew Charlton of Aviation Advocacy.
Price has been the only thing that matters for airlines, and therefore they look at every single expense. One of those expenses is airport charges.
But however much the airports want to charge, the actual amount is usually decided or at least influenced by some kind of regulator. And Primo says that is why this nasty and long-simmering dispute is so public.
publicly complaining can actually have some effect, because ultimately these are to some degree economic decisions by the airports, but there's also an element of politics involved because many of these decisions are subject to the oversight of governments.
Experts say this long-running dispute will likely keep on running. Airports and airlines need each other. They just also apparently hate each other. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
We talk a lot about the bigs in this economy. Big banks, big oil, big pharma, big tobacco, all testaments to consolidation and market power. There is another big out there that only recently has started to get a whole lot of attention. You happen upon it if and when you stop at the butcher's counter in the supermarket. Forbes writer Chloe Sorvino has a new book out about the meat industry. It's called Raw Deal: Hidden Corruption, Corporate Greed, and the Fight for the Future of Meat. Chloe, thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
How did we get here where we've got fundamentally in this country, and I say this with capital B, capital M, big meat?
So many different ways, but really over the past century, nothing has essentially changed. The Packers and Stockyards Act of 1921 was set up in place because there was already massive amounts of consolidation and issues with collusion and other market manipulation. And now, roughly 100 years later, here we are with the top meat packers controlling huge swaths of the industry. And in beef, you have 80% controlled by the top four players. In pork, you have 70% controlled by the top four players. And in chicken, you have more than 60%. It's a lot of wealth and power.
And then we get to the pandemic, you know, to jump ahead 100 years or so. And slaughterhouses and meatpacking plants become a challenge for the virus and a challenge for our food supply, sort of.
Absolutely. You saw many meatpackers working hand in hand with state, local, and federal government to keep plants open, to keep workers showing up on the line and, you know, putting them in harm's way to make more profits, to keep exporting meat, to keep selling more meat to more fast food restaurants around the world. And then you have thousands of workers getting sick, hundreds dying, and a huge mess.
Just because you mentioned workers, and now again the concept of scale, it has to be pointed out here, and anybody who's read about this knows, working conditions inside big meat slaughterhouses and packing houses are, to be charitable, terrible.
The vulnerability of these workers and how violent these workplaces have become really can't be understated. And I spent hours and months digging through thousands of pages of lawsuits and different testimony around worker cases of harassment and discrimination. The patterns of retaliation and brutal treatment are horrible. And there have been some significant settlements that speak to how the industry has, you know, allegedly colluded and kept their workers subjugated at low levels of wages and benefits and healthcare.
Yeah. Can we talk a little solutions journalism here for a second? There is, of course, plant-based meats now. There is laboratory-grown meat, which is a tiny sliver of a percentage. But what's the meat future, I guess, is my question.
There is always going to be a place for meat, but meat production completely has to change. And it's going to be everyone's job, from the workers at these big meat packers to the workers at the plants to, you know, the retailers and the buyers and the distributors and the truckers. It's going to take everyone because we're up against a massive, massive challenge.
You tried to do ethical and accessible meat shopping as part of your research for this book. How'd it go?
I'm a big fan of my CSA, my community-supported farm share, and I think the best way that consumers can think about how to actually vote with their dollars, it really ends up happening when that dollar is being used to support the financial system that really supports local farming at the end of the day. And the reason I write about the alternatives, the reason I write about local food is because there's so much money and energy around trying to take a bite out of big meat, but nothing really has been working. And that is how big meat has continued to maintain such power and control for so long.
Chloe Sorvino is a staff writer at Forbes. She's also now a book author. It's called Raw Deal, Hidden Corruption, Corporate Greed, and the Fight for the Future of Meat. Chloe, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
This final note on the way out today, a sad milestone in commercial aviation. At some point tonight, at the Boeing factory up in Everett, Washington, the 1,574th and last Boeing 747 is going to roll off the assembly line. It's been more than 50 years that the Queen of the Skies has been in production. This last one goes to Atlas Air. They do cargo and charter flights. Boeing, of course, still recovering from the 737 MAX crashes of a couple of years ago. All right, we're out of here, but here is your moment of economic context. Just because we talked for a bit on the show today about Pentagon procurement, the controller for the Department of Defense told reporters today that the department has failed its audit again. In fact, the Pentagon has never passed one of its audits. It does have $3.5 trillion in assets, $3.7 trillion in liabilities. It took 1,600 auditors to go through the books, after which the Department of Defense could not properly account for 61% of its assets. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Miettinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, Antonio Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director of digital and on-demand around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.